Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege to welcome to the Soleri Report a very special investigative reporter and author. Her name is Anne Williamson, and I first met her in the early 2000s. I was in London and speaking at an investment conference, and Anne had covered Russia and the changes in Russia after the wall came down in the 90s as a correspondent for the Wall or reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and then had become an independent and covered it on her own and wrote a very compelling and amazing book about those years called Contagion that was then serialized. All sorts of dirty tricks around the publication. Hopefully we'll have time to talk about it today. And it was never published, but portions of it were serialized through an investment research firm in London. And I had the chance to read that as well. But the time that I met Anne, I was speaking about sort of the rape of government, and privatization is really a way of moving assets at below market cost to private companies in America. And Anne was speaking about a similar process in Russia. And John Laughlin, who has been on the Soleri Report, marvelous reporter and writer from London at the time, was talking about Eastern Europe. And the three of us realized, oh my God, we're talking about the same law firms, the same university endowments, the same investors. It's sort of the same bunch of pirates who are running around the globe doing this in every place. And it's a global model, and it's, you know, and it's similar. It's a similar playbook in every continent. And it was quite a magical moment when we said, oh my God, you know, we're onto something. And that's what caused me to write what is now a very famous blog post called Financial Coup d'Etat, which if you haven't read, I suggest it on the blog. But meeting Anne was a life-changing moment. She then, among other things, wrote a series for WorldNet Daily explaining the Federal Reserve, the IMF, and a variety of global financial institutions. And I dare say it was the first time many of us really understood how all those systems work. So she has an incredible ability to go in and kind of understand how things work both bottom up and top down and explain it to people who, you know, didn't want to make understanding the financial system's life work. So we're talking to a very, very special person. And two other things I have to add. One of my favorite Anne Williamson pieces is a hit job, and a well-deserved hit job she did on Schiller. making mincemeat of the economists who provide the pro-centralization Team Air cover. And finally, I just want to say that when it comes to understanding what's going on in Russia and the Ukraine, Anne's work is a very important backstory. And of course, she's very knowledgeable about that part of the world. So we'll be talking about the backstory of what happened in Russia in the 90s, but bring it down to today. And finally, Anne, just let me say, I know you're in the process of launching a new business and moving to Europe. And so the fact that you're joining us today is it's a real opportunity for all of us to understand that part of the world and what's going on. And we really, really appreciate it. So, Anne Williamson, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. And thank you for sharing your Soleri audience with me. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, take us back. How in the world did you end up in Russia after the wall came down? And tell us what you discovered and how it led to Contagion and what Contagion said.
Well, it was kind of odd because during the years of the Cold War, Moscow was considered, you know, sort of a dead end zone for a journalist. Mostly it was a lot of drunks hanging out at the Metropole Hotel at 5 p.m. in the bar, waiting for the translations from TASS. And they would quickly go to their rooms, write up the report based on the information they received from the government, and return to the bar. Day after day, decade after decade. What I'm saying is that the West found itself really unprepared, completely unprepared for the collapse of the Soviet Union. We didn't even have common everyday information. Uh-huh. And I had studied Russian history and Russian language at university. I had studied in the Soviet Union, hated it, and dropped the whole business and was furious because I'd ruined a beautiful French accent for a very bad Russian accent. Bad trade. I kept thinking, I could have been in Paris. What have I done? But then suddenly, I don't know why to this day, I got reinterested and I started, you know, dragging out the old Glagolda Vigiani books and restudying the Russian language. And all of a sudden, this guy, Gorbachev, came to power. And for once, I was 15 seconds ahead of my time. Because why I got such good opportunities was because I knew the language, I knew the country, and I was willing. So off I went, and I probably got a lot better work than I would have as a just an entry journalist, because my first real job was with the Wall Street Journal as a journalist. So that was great good fortune. And then, you know, I was really started covering the country actually in the arts, because Perestroika began in the film industry and media. And so that was really an exciting time. It was a wonderful time because you had Russian friends and Soviet friends, and the world was finally opening up for these people after having lived under that terrible ideology and economic system for seven decades. So it was just a great time. And then they finally got to travel and visit the United States. And boy, we all thought everything was going to come out really well in the end. And I remember thinking, all the years I'd watched the Soviets struggle, that they were like a prize fighter in the ring with one hand tied behind them, thanks to the ideology. And I really thought, this country has so much wealth, and those people are so clever. It will be fantastic to see what they come up with.
Right, and the science and technology.
The resources of resources for the world. I mean, it was just great contemplating this future and to cease the wasteful spending on the military, the much desired peace dividend. Well, how naive was I? The ugly truth was Washington went into a panic. There is this very unfortunate mentality amongst Americans, particularly those who work for the federal government. It's a Manichean view of the world, you know, white hats and black hats. You hear it all the time when you talk to the foreign policy people. Well, we're the good guys. We're the white hats. Oh, those are the black hats. You know, and it's really quite funny talking to them because you kind of keep remembering, if you're a baby boomer, those old 1950s children's shows and shoot 'em ups and stuff, because that seems to be the governing mentality. But at any rate, the Soviets made wonderful enemies. They looked like Europeans, but inside they were, you know, these Asiatic people. And so that was confusing for that. But they were really great enemies because they looked like us, a lot of them. And, you know, they were behind this wall they had built themselves. They really couldn't respond very well in the public arena. So you could, you know, attribute anything to them. And they really didn't have much of a chance to respond. And then, of course, the regime did some pretty ugly things all on its own. And that wasn't a very good advertisement. So the U.S., it really did have a field day in the Cold War, or the United States did. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Anthony Sutton.
Yes.
He was a researcher at Stanford, a Cambridge man. Wonderful, wonderful work. And he's traced the whole history of how the United States actually assisted the Soviet Union to viability.
Right.
They didn't.
We were the ones who really financed. We really financed the communists.
We did. We did indeed. Right. And also the fascists, but that's another story. At any rate, so Herbert Walker Bush was just in a panic. And what's kind of interesting when we look back from our perspective today is that Bush wanted, in late 1992, after the coup against Gorbachev and his return to Moscow and the collapse of the Communist Party, Ukraine voted on whether or not it would become an independent country or stay with Russia. And that was in late December. And at that time, in that referendum, Ukraine did vote for independence, but Crimea voted to stay with Russia by 94%. And that referendum was repeated in 94, and again it was in the 90th percentile. And then, of course, we have the one from last April, I believe it was, when we got, I think, a 96, somewhere between 96 and 97% positive for return to Russia. But George Bush went to Kiev, Herbert Walker Bush, and gave a speech encouraging the Ukrainians to stay as part of Russia or the Soviet. In fact, then he was arguing that they stay a part of the Soviet Union. He didn't actually want the country to collapse. And that was immediately ridiculed and is what became known as the Chicken Kiev speech. So it's interesting to see how in those subsequent years, from 1991 to 2014, the very different view that we have today of Ukraine, or that our foreign policy people have of Ukraine and what their goals are. And what we see happening in Ukraine, just the beginnings with the IMF loans and this terrible business with Vice President Biden's son, very obviously being put on board the Ukrainian Energy Company's board, which he was really to oversee a privatization of 49% of that entity's shares for targeted Westerners. It's beginning very quickly, but we see a repeat of what happened in Russia, and that is essentially they come in with big money. You have a new leader who's got to get a constituency quickly. So that money's very helpful because doesn't matter the country, he can use it to buy his supporters. In Russia's case, you had all the property of what is probably the most naturally wealthy country on earth up for grabs. So Yeltsin had Western money to distribute and property to distribute.
And I should also just insert in, the reality was, if the United States and the Anglo-American alliance was going to control the oil trade in sort of the post-Soviet period, you needed to get, you know, the big seven sister, the big oil companies needed to assert control of that oil and gas load.
Absolutely. Right. And they were frustrated because Gazprom, which was really even Gazprom today, it's the old Soviet Ministry of Gas, really, and of course new people have come on board, but that is the core of that company, which was just the ministry privatized. And they were very proactive. They were smart. They cut themselves out of the whole privatization scheme. I mean, they did privatize, but under a different program. So they were never available to the West. And that caused even greater focus on the oil companies, which were subject to privatization, but of course mostly by insiders, and then favored Westerners. So you're quite correct. They wanted to get control of those oil companies. But what's interesting is they soon understood this wasn't going to be easy, because there were plenty of Russians and former Soviet citizens who had the same objective. So the West got the big idea, see, we'll ace them another way, through the transport system. And this is the theme that is still playing out today. And Ukraine is a new chapter of that. What's going on in Ukraine now is the latest chapter of that story.
Now, one of the things I just wanted to mention, we've done a series of interviews with Jim Norman, who I think is really terrific. And I don't know if you've read his book, The Oil Card, but he talks about one of the things that the oil card. He talks, his theory is that the Reagan administration did everything they could to bring the oil price down to help bust the Soviet Union. But then afterwards, one of the important reasons to get control of the Russian assets was if you were going to checkmate China, you needed to bring the price up. And you didn't want to do that until you asserted control of those Russian assets. And that's why Treasury was so critical to the rape of Russia, because, you know, the whole Treasury covert side was in there from the beginning, because that was part of manipulating the oil price up, is making sure you controlled those before that happened.
That's right. And there's even a earlier chapter from before Reagan, with under Brezhnev. It was right. Brezhnev who really began exporting energy. That's when the Europe began building, constructing the pipes and so forth for Russian
right.
gas. But what Brezhnev did by doing that is he began the trade in dollars. He became part of the petrodollar system and thereby began importing U.S. inflation into the Russian economy. And that was the Soviet economy. And that
right.
was one challenge that they confronted only in the 90s. Did the, you know, the chickens come home to roost, so to speak.
Right.
And that made them very vulnerable to Reagan's program, in which Mr. Norman is correct. They were reducing the price of oil with the cooperation with the Saudis.
Right.
And yes, I mean, that's the other conundrum of the Iraqi war, because people think, yes, it was about oil, but the odd thing there is they really, that was to hold the price of oil down. They did not want all the Iraqi oil to come to market, and Saddam Hussein was interested in doing that.
Right.
Just as Gaddafi was very interested in developing his oil industry, and we see what happened to both gentlemen.
Right.
But it was because the West did not want that oil to come to market yet.
Right. They want to control the price.
Mr.
Right.
Norman's theory.
Right. And you have to control the supply. Well, tell us about how, so the privatization went forward in Russia. And tell us what it did to the Russian economy and the Russian people.
Well, there's a couple of interesting points about privatization. Number one, you will hear the people who conduct it defend themselves and their miserable results with the idea, well, we had no choice. We were under pressure. We had to do this. The communists may have come back, you know. Oh, it was such pressure and anxiety. And it's really a lot of poppycock. Because it was actually the Supreme Soviet of the Soviet Union in July 1992 that mandated a national privatization program. And it was that Duma, or that Supreme Soviet, that was furious that the program was not being presented. And then when the new Duma was elected under Russian President Boris Yeltsin, these same people from the Communist Party and other non-Gaidar, non-Western reformer parties were very anxious to get the privatization program going, and were actually very unhappy with the foot dragging that was going on, which was really just power plays between Goldman Sachs and Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard. So that was part of the reason for the delay. Then when the program, after the program was complete, the voucher privatization, listeners may recall that Yeltsin then attacked his own parliament with cannon. There was a siege of the parliament in 1994, which was very shocking to the Russian people. The reaction in the West was, I'll never forget it, the New Republic called Boris Yeltsin a muscular Democrat.
Mm.
when he's bombing his own parliament. But what was never communicated in the United States was that the dispute was over voucher privatization. The Duma wanted it reversed. They said it was a horrible result. There'd been nothing but thieving and swindling. And they were quite correct. But I doubt that you could find that mentioned anywhere in the West coverage of those events.
Right.
I never did.
Right.
So that was, so privatization was controversial from the beginning. And what they did, you know, they took a valuation for the nation's assets as of July 1, 1992. They just sort of drafted a balance sheet, divided it by a population of 150 million, and came up with this 10,000 ruble voucher that was to be used to privatization options by each Russian citizen who was entitled to one voucher. But what they did was fascinating. First of all, two-thirds of the assets were immediately excluded from voucher privatization. Then the remaining one-third was divided in half again. And half of that remaining third was excluded. And then the remaining half of that third from a two previous divisions was what was actually auctioned. So very little of the national property was made available to the people. You couldn't get information. You know, if you wanted to do a little due diligence, you couldn't get it. You had to bribe people in the government to get it. So, of course, much more vigorous players got that information. And who were those vigorous players? Well, they were the golden children of the old Soviet nomenklatura. You see, overnight, Russia became a young man's country. All of those old bolsheviks, they knew they weren't in any kind of condition to deal with it. They only knew they wanted to get the property in their own hands. So their sons came to the fore. And you have a lot of famous characters from that era who really began operating as early as 1985. People like Khodorkovsky and Kuczynski, the great oligarchs that came up in the following 10 years. And with the voucher privatization, the other really cruel thing that happened was after these vouchers were distributed, all these investment funds sprang up, and the Harvard people and the, you know, eager young reformers encouraged the public to use those funds.
I want to emphasize so everybody understands, one of the roles that Harvard played was they got a enormous contract from the State Department to be financial advisor to the government. But the endowment was playing, and the different pots related to their endowment was playing, you know, sort of in there as well. So there were enormous conflicts of interest, and it was one of those periods when the endowment ballooned tremendously. This is, I guess, you at this point, you also had Bob Rubin at Treasury. Is this Clinton administration, or are we still? We're in Clinton administration now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So Harvard's in there playing lots of different sides, right?
It's good you mention that because Harvard got those contracts without competition, which was not really allowed under government regulations.
Except for this, we should mention that Rubin, before he became the National Economic Advisor and then Secretary of the Treasury, was the chairman of the Harvard Endowment.
Yes, and he was also the co-leader of Goldman Sachs. But Mr. Rubin, I want to write this article one day for him. It'll be my gift, his bright shining moment. It was when Goldman Sachs, this was in the autumn of 1992, and Goldman Sachs was still a private partnership at that time. It had not gone public. So therefore, the partner's personal fortunes were at risk.
Right.
That was a far better arrangement than the one we have today. But at any rate, they wanted, this was a huge opportunity for finance, of course. So at the same time that the Harvard academics are there trying to get their fingers in control of all the pots, Goldman Sachs came in, and Robert Rubin did negotiate an agreement with the Russians for Goldman Sachs to handle the privatizations of large properties. And that would actually have been a good thing, because then Goldman Sachs would have been responsible to the government of the Russian Federation by contract. They could be dismissed if the government was unhappy. They had to deliver. They had the kind of experience to take on some of those big enterprises and try to break them down and make them palatable to private investors.
True. Well, that's true.
Goldman Sachs went crazy. There was a picture of Sergei Grigoryev, who was a Russian official who helped negotiate this agreement, and Mr. Rubin shaking hands in the Wall Street Journal. And that led to a huge embarrassment for Goldman Sachs, because the Harvard people, the academics, were running around handing out the money to Chubais, to Gaidar, to Yeltsin, to this one, to that one, and thereby getting their support for the academics to run the show, not Mr. Rubin. And that's a really unfortunate thing. And that's another problem with foreign aid, is the foreign government never has any control. You know, if you just take it, we run the show. That's why I say it was Mr. Rubin's bright and shining moment, because it would have given control to the Russians. So with that kind of obscure detail, but I think it's an important one. So the contract was non-competed, given to Harvard, and not all those people were money thieves. They were opportunists. They were careerists. They were trying to build great reputations as economists off of Russia. And as one Russian remarked, he said, oh, it's an old story for us. And then during the era of Peter the Great, European sergeants would come to Russia to become generals. It was the same thing, really. We know the syndrome, they told me many times. So that was really part of the story, too. And these people, they wanted their brilliant program followed step by step, because they were trying to build their own reputations. And of course, these people really did not understand at all what they were doing. And I think part of the story going forward is, yes, it's true. Communism was a ridiculous economic system that was doomed to defeat. We never needed the Cold War. We should have just held on to our own ideas. It is an unworkable system. It's never succeeded anywhere it's been put in place without massive coercion of the population. It's just a loser's game. But now we're going to see the collapse of an almost equally stupid economic system.
Right. Organized crime doesn't work anywhere near.
Keynesianism isn't too great either. Neither is central banking. So now the world, we've lived through most of the Soviet collapse. Not really. We haven't even lived through all the consequences of World War I, if you take the historic view. But, you know, ahead of us is the collapse of this very peculiar system that's grown up over the last 40 years since the U.S. went off gold.
Right.
So that's the era we're in now, and it's not a very happy one, but I only make the point that, you know, this system has some really strange contradictions as well. Putting consumption before production, you know, on and on, penalizing savers. There's so many things are wrong with Keynesianism. It's amazing it functions at all, really.
It is amazing.
And I think a large part of its functioning is due to the reserve role that the U.S. dollar plays. That was another thing. When the wall collapsed and when the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, we were all looking forward to a peace dividend. But what Washington saw was, hey, there are billions, with India and China and Russia in the mix, there's probably 3 billion new potential dollar holders out there.
Right.
So Washington was very excited. We can push a lot of money out the door. And they did.
Right.
And accepted it.
Right. So let me just talk about, because I want to get to the Ukraine today. What happened, my recollection was that between 1990 and 2000, you literally saw the population of Russia fall. Well, one person said at the beginning there were, a very small number living in poverty, and by the end of the decade, it had exploded in numbers, and the population shrunk 25 million.
Well, I don't think quite 25. The population was cut in half when the Soviet Union collapsed. If you look at it from a Russian's point of view, the size of the country, its borders were returned to those that were prevalent under Catherine the Great.
Right.
And they lost half their population. So that was a very shocking thing to people. That's a disconcerting development, as you can imagine, if you woke up one morning and half the United States was gone.
Right.
Including that part of the population. So you were down to about 150 million people in 1992, 150 million Russians. And
right.
Today it's about 142 million, though the projections are grim. But they are no more grim, I would say, than most of Europe. We are declining. Now, Mr. Putin has worked very hard to try to reverse that, and he did have, they finally got a positive year on the birth rate, and it has been going up. It may be another reason for the events in Ukraine, to stop those positive developments that Russia had worked very hard to create.
But it's fair to say that the what happened after the wall came down is the Western interests behaved in a way that did great harm to the population.
Oh,
is that fair to say?
Terrible things to the Russian people. So many lives were destroyed. The biggest thing they did, the really ugliest thing, was how they managed what they called the ruble overhang. Sounds really scary, the ruble overhang. What was that? Well, the ruble overhang was the national savings. You see, under communism, there wasn't anything to buy. So people saved their money. And there was a lot of savings in Russia in 1992. And this was a problem, because what if those Russian people used their money to buy their national property? Ooh, that would bring a lot of competitors into the auctions, into the market process. So the West, very cleverly, the Harvard academics, got Yeltsin to announce the freeing of wage and price controls, which should have been done, but he named the exact date 3 months into the future. So therefore, all producers ceased delivery. They started hoarding, getting ready for the big feast. And when it came, he did release wages and prices. It set off a 2,500% inflation in 1992.
Mm.
That was the end of the problem of ruble overhang or the people's savings. And that's really something to consider, because if you look at U.S. history, it wasn't World War II that really brought the U.S. out of the Great Depression, and actually continued even through the war. It was rationing. The same thing happened to the American people. You couldn't buy anything during the war, so people saved their money. When the war ended and all those GIs came home, the people had savings.
Right.
And that set off, it was a big part of the post World War II boom in the United States, particularly the 1950s. So you certainly didn't want something like that to occur in Russia. And it would have.
Well, we also had stories of banks and pension funds being literally just emptied out and the money stolen and laundered out of the country.
Everything was emptied out. I always say, you know, that if territory were exportable, Russia would be the size of Luxembourg.
Right.
I mean, they just shipped out everything. And some of that, of course, was the people, well-positioned people, Russians, looting the country themselves. But the real role the West played was coming in and showing those people how to move that money, how to get it through the banking system, how to you know, literally empty the pension fund and get the money to some foundation.
It's kind of like the technology we brought to Russia was financial fraud. We taught mm-hmm. them, being communists, they weren't anywhere near as schooled in financial fraud as we were.
Well, the economists didn't understand the country at all, the people who got, you know, hold of this process, because, you know, the Soviet Union had an economy. It even had a market economy, but it was a black market economy.
Right.
What needed to be done was to open it up. You didn't necessarily have to come in and start creating all these imitations of the West. There were organic markets already
right.
in existence, but you needed to, you know, as I say, bring it out into the public square. But they didn't want that because those were experienced players.
One of the things that got me talking, you know, one of the reasons I was so interested in your work was I had a theory that the Russian mafia was, some of the money that the Russian mafia laundered out was being used, or it was coming back into the exchange stabilization fund and being used to bid on the HUD loan sales. So, you know, when I started to read all about the Russian mafia, including Robert Friedman's book, Red Mafia, and one of the things that triggered, it was sort of the last run, I said, I have to get Ann Williamson on the Soleri Report, was I was interviewing Zach Taylor. It was an interview we'll post this week. And he is a former Border Patrol officer, including doing intelligence work, and was explaining to me that the Russian mafia is the most powerful force in the cartels in Mexico City. And I thought, well, you know, that makes me nervous because I know that they laundered a lot of money into Israel in the 90s and sort of got a position there, that they were laundering into New York. Suddenly now they're in Mexico City on our border. And, you know, I said to myself, look, if you look at the people who are looking to build out the big investment in the in Mexico and Latin America, including, you know, Mexico just opened up their oil and gas to investment. I said, this is beginning to look like the guys who did Russia. So I said, I've got to talk to Ann and see, okay, you know, is the Russian mafia teamed up with the same people, you know, on our border? What does this mean? Because I also know they've got a toehold in the Ukraine. So I said, what, you know.
It's so hard to say when you talk about the Russian mafia. We naturally associate this term with the mafia as we understand it.
But right, and it's not.
No, it's not. It's different. How can I explain it? And very often it's hard to understand.
Yeah, because it's fractured.
Yeah, and where does it end and the government begin? But that's
right.
A statement you can make about the United States at this point.
Right, you can, absolutely, you can. Although what Friedman said was that the Russian mafia was 99% Jewish. And so if you looked at the time I studied them, at their linkages, they were not just, you know, to a particular country, but they were very tied into the networks where there's a strong Jewish community. So New York, Israel, and I have much less understanding of what their networks are in Russia today.
Well, Odessa.
right.
That's the great traditional city of the Soviet or Russian mafia, Jewish mafia. They're very active. And it, a really odd thing about that is I don't think this was anybody's plan. It just happened this way. If you recall, in the 70s and 80s, there was enormous support for Russian Jews to expatriate from the Soviet Union, and they were given preference in the United States. So a large portion of almost all Russian immigration was actually Jewish immigration. And these people had already established themselves in the West by the time the Soviet Union collapsed. They already knew the ropes. They already had businesses. They already had contacts in Europe for foundations, for banks, etc. Also, in the Soviet Union, all those giant enterprises, this is another part of the market that was there that we didn't see or understand. You know, the top guy was always a Russian, but number two was always a Jew. And, you know, these, and there was a whole network of Jewish traders who, you know, the factory needed bolts, but the nearest supplier of bolts, he was out, and he was, you know, four republics to the west. And so suddenly we got to find these bolts, or we're not going to make our production quota, and then we won't get our bonuses, and blah, blah, blah. So these traders actually worked the system and found the raw materials for the giant.
So they were a lot of the muscle in the economy already.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Smart, clever guys who knew where everything valuable was and understood how those enterprises worked and were able to stay alive. Plus, you know, they knew the director's name. They knew Gennady Markovich over there and Novosibirsk. And, you know, they knew all the players and the fans. And these were people whom the West should have sought out. These guys knew what was going on. If anybody should have been empowered domestically, it was that group. Not that any group should have been pre-selected, but I mean, this is who.
But you needed to get all the intellectual and financial know-how and use it.
And so when the system was collapsing, these Jews immigrated. And they immigrated right into established communities, you see. And so they were able to pull, ultimately, a lot of the wealth out of the country. Now, I wouldn't necessarily call that a Jewish mafia.
No, I don't think it was. I just think it's those networks.
It was a network, exactly. Yeah. And it was greatly empowered by something. Yes, there was great pressure to get Jews out of the Soviet Union, and the United States was a big player in that. But the end game was, what happened was not necessarily meant to be the end game. But because of the way we played it, we pulled those people out of the country when they should have stayed. They had a great role to play. So you have, you know, now a Russian would look at that network and call it a mafia. But, and to them it is. So I'm just saying sometimes when you hear even Robert Friedman, who does not speak Russian, by the way, hears.
You know, he died right after the book was published.
Yes, I spoke with Robert quite a few times, and that was a real tragedy that he passed away so young. But he did not actually speak Russian, and he got into the Russia story by kind of some coincidental meetings or introductions. And sometimes, you know, he didn't really always have the context for some of the information he got. So I would just point out that's kind of a difference. And, you know, it's such an emotionally laden word that people, it conjures up all these images. But there are some very, you know, you don't want to mess around with real Russian mafia. They're serious people. They're serious criminals. And, of course, they're like criminals the world over. They're looking for a way to get their money into the system. And the really big laundry for Russian money today is London.
That's
sort of changed there in the knots. It went from Israel to London. So,
but didn't a lot come in through New York?
We still have pound sterling.
Right.
Because actually governments want that money to enter the banks, but
right.
under their terms and to their benefit.
Right.
So
yeah. Take us to the Ukraine today. What in the world is going on? How did this happen?
Well, I think the big point for the West, or the United States, is that Ukraine, if you look at it geographically, is basically a highway into Russia. You know, that's where how the armies of Napoleon, of Charles of Sweden, you know, many invaders, Hitler, they all came through Ukraine because it's the easiest access to Russia. It's also the easiest egress, and that is why so many of the pipelines, the major energy pipelines, do go through Ukraine. And I'm convinced that part of what they have had no success in getting the oil companies under their control. Mr. Putin has been outfoxing them ever since that awful loans for shares program of 1995, which was terribly upsetting to the Russian people on top of the awful voucher privatization. Really, it's taken the Putin administration this long to get the oil companies back where he wanted them, which is about mm-hmm. where they were in 1995, with half government ownership. So they can't get directly to the oil companies, so the transport routes have become ever more important. And with the building of Nord Stream and the now interrupted construction of South Stream, which are two pipes Russia built to skirt Ukraine and are meant to deliver gas to Europe, you know, now they're threatened. So it's what I don't understand is why the EU is cooperating in this economic suicide that the U.S. is insisting upon, because the long game is to get those transport routes. But if South Stream is built and completed, Ukraine is going to lose its importance as a transport venue. So I think the United States has moved now because they wanted to get the job done before that happened.
Right.
And not only will it pull the gas and the oil through Ukraine, they want to pull everything else and really isolate Russia and more or less indirectly get control of Russia's energy assets through the transport, but through control of the transport system. So it's a very dangerous play. Very, very bold. And I just don't think it's going to work. But how bad is it going to get? This is the unknown. As I told you just before our interview began, I was reading an article on Drudge that there's an accusation, a Bloomberg article, that Russia hacked some big, J.P. Morgan, I think, in mid-August. You know, and of course, it's stated one way that this absolutely happened, and then you read the article, and it's Russia may have, you know, there's all these qualifiers. And I thought, that's interesting. This allegation appears just before those talks began in Ukraine between Mr. Putin and Poroshenko.
Right.
So that's very, you know, they've already got something ready, you know, to hurl at the Russians to make sure.
You know, I was, I told you Ambrose Pritchard Evans, Evans Pritchard just did an interview with Laura Scholl and talked about the group at Treasury that's been developing a whole new set of sanctions. And I'm assuming he was referring to some of the ones they've been using on the Russian leadership.
Yeah.
But when you look at those sanctions, what they're doing, and I know you and I have both experienced some of those, a taste of that kind of stuff personally. What you realize is when you say bold, the Americans, this is not only bold, but it's bold at an intimate level, because they're bringing financial sanctions in very personally vicious ways to a wide variety of people.
And I think, because another interesting development was that insane judgment on behalf of Yukos of $50 billion for four thieves who never paid a penny for the asset.
Well, you know, I don't understand how the Yukos settlement fits in, and I would love it if you could explain that.
I couldn't quite hear your question, Catherine.
I don't quite understand how the Yukos system fits in, or the settlement fits in, and maybe you could describe that now.
Well, this Yukos story is really something else. It began, Mr. Hodorkovsky he's a brilliant person, and he was a successful person from the beginning. He was head at one point of Moskovsky Komsomol, very prominent. And he was given investment capital by the KGB, which was a very smart decision because he was successful, as I say, from the beginning.
Right.
And, of course, he was also rapacious and ruthless. And it was actually a man named Mr. Potanin of Ox-Im Bank and Norilsk Nickel who came up with the loans for shares scheme. But probably Hodorkovsky played it best, because he got control of a lot of oil in those auctions that, with the results pre-agreed. And they used stand-ins at the auctions. And I remember the winning bidder for Yukos was tracked down after the auction. And, you know, it was just he was just a drunk in some podunk Russian town. So they used a lot of cutouts and so forth. Then they get control of the assets. The government actually gave them money, and they bought into the Russian bond market, which was a creation, very interesting, of the United States Treasury. And
right.
Off-the-books program initiated by Gerald Corrigan and Herbert Walker Bush in 1991. They were getting the bond market ready to roll. So, and that's a program almost nobody knows anything about, and yet it was a key element in the whole mix of the 1990s. Because at one point, they were paying 290% yields on three-month paper, which is
good Lord.
Crazy. Of course, that's not even a market price.
Well, it's a way of skimming the equity out through the back door.
Right. It was a pass-through program.
Yeah. Right.
They were really essentially U.S. taxpayers' contributions to the IMF were actually paying those yields on Russian bonds, which were known as DKOs. And, you know, it was going to people who were buying them illegally because Russia had passed legislation that excluded foreigners above 10% of the market. So everybody ran out and found a Russian as a stand-in and so forth. And then these guys who participated in loans for shares, you know, they made a fortune investing the government money in those bonds. They never paid for the assets. Now, Hodorkovsky continued his ruthless activities for about three more years, and people who had purchased Yukos, investors, were furious. If you go back and look, you'll find a lot of negative press on him. But then, in I think it was 1998, he totally changed his tactics. The guy is so smart. He started paying a huge dividend and said, I'm going to play by the rules. He brought in you know, an appropriate accountancy work from the West. I mean, he put out clean books. He paid a huge dividend. And, you know, overnight, the Western Yukos shareholders were thrilled. You know, now Hodorkovsky's the best guy in the world. Well, you have to go back to what the real idea of privatization was. The U.S. had set it up so that, you know, the old nomenclatura, they cooperated for the nomenclatura to get the assets, criminals, speculators, just no goodniks. They did that intentionally because their idea was, these thieves, let them steal. Let them steal all they can, because they will never be able to manage those huge enterprises, and they will want to cash out, and they will sell to us cheap. That was the idea. That's mm-hmm. one reason we supported all these nefarious people, because the powers that be assumed we're eventually going to get those assets. Well, they never got them. The boys held on. And Mr. Hodorkovsky, the most successful of them, in the end, ironically, is now their asset. So the thing that the Western shareholders didn't understand was that who's the biggest shareholder of Yukos? Well, Mikhail Hodorkovsky. So, of course, he was paying those huge dividends. It was simply a way for him to get the money out of Yukos into his own pocket. And then right. he started playing politics with that money. He was literally trying to buy the entire Duma. Then he entered into discussions to sell somewhere between 40 and 50% of the firm to ExxonMobil and Chevron, who were the bidders. And you know, this was never, ever going to happen. There is nobody, no Russian leader who could have sat in the Kremlin and allowed an asset that was never paid for, that is truly part of the Russian people's legacy, be sold to the West and the profits go into a single individual's pocket. It just never was going to happen. And, of course, Mr. Putin had warned those guys, you get into politics, you're out. And that's what happened to Mr. Hodorkovsky. But by then, the West considered him their greatest success. And that is why there's been so a large reason for why there's been so much positive publicity about the guy. And Putin has been so denigrated for the prosecution of Hodorkovsky.
Now, so Anne, given the judgment in the Hague, is there any way that he can literally enforce that judgment in Russia?
Well, I don't think he can enforce it really. But what he can do, which is just as bad, is dog Russia in every court in the land. Anywhere right. they have an asset, he can file a claim. Now, whether the national court of a certain country will entertain that claim, I can't say now. But certainly the U.S. is going to be there encouraging them to do so. So they can just complicate life for the Russians more than every nation on earth, essentially.
And, so let me ask you, why is Europe going along with this? Is you know, you see us say we're bringing fracking technology to Ukraine, we're bringing fracking technology to Europe, presumably the deposits off of Israel will go to Europe. Why is Europe going along with this?
Boy, that is really the question. I think Russia, you know, the Fed was pumping so much money that was going ultimately to Europe after 2008. We really don't have a clear idea of what agreements were made
right.
for those dollars. And the answer could lie there. But I keep having the very uncomfortable feeling, and Paul Craig Roberts hints at this, and well, he actually does state it several times in his work, that the individual leaders have been picked off with compromising information, threats to them. I mean, you notice today Christine Lagarde of the IMF is in some hot water in France. And maybe four.
Yeah, that investigation, you know, they raided her apartment about 6 or 12 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they've waved that flag before at her. And I'm just wondering what that's about.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a pretty long life story. She's been dealing with that problem for actually at least several years.
Right.
But she hasn't been able to quiet the situation, and you don't hear anything about it, and then suddenly here it's flaring up. And her predecessor, who was falsely accused, I mean, he was a roué, but this business with a New York City hotel maid, I think was a setup, but they got rid of him, and he was talking back. They didn't like that. I know that Angela Merkel was their choice for German chancellor, and they worked very hard to make sure that Gerhard Schroeder lost that election, I think of 2004. He was just a little too interested in Germany's interest to suit the Americans. So,
well, that may be possible because, you know, it's clear from the sanctions they've tried to exercise in Russia that, you know, between control files and sort of NSA systems doing surveillance and being able to implement different, you know, negative media and negative legal and financial actions individually against people without any authority, without, you know, having an indictment or anything else, you know, the techniques of control have reached a new extraordinary level. And I think that's what Ambrose pictured. Well, I don't...
In this $50 million judgment for Yukos, I think this is part of the story, because who would have real insight into those relationships in the Kremlin who is now considered a Western asset? Mr. Khodorkovsky.
Mm-hmm.
So that's invaluable information for them. And, you know, if he could possibly get that $50 billion, even though he's not a shareholder, but I would not be fooled by that legal status. He signed his shares over to Platonov, who's in Israel, and I'm sure there's a private agreement about that.
Right.
But if Khodorkovsky can get that kind of money back in his pocket, then they could conceivably, it would certainly increase his chances of taking out Putin. I think they actually have the idea that with enough time, they can pull the same stunt in Moscow that they pulled off in Kiev with these new information sources and their financial technology.
I don't know. I think the it's funny. I don't know the Russians well. You do. But you know the story of the Russian who tried to, who was a Putin advisor, tried to recruit me in 2005. And what he said, yeah, I was up in at the Gold Conference in the Yukon.
Oh,
and yeah, there was a national security advisor to Putin who was there, and he tried to recruit me. It was quite extraordinary, and I'll never forget saying to him, I said, you know, nobody likes a traitor. So, you know, I'm stuck with some, you know, a rotten, you know, I don't like my current leadership, but I haven't given up on my people. So the answer is no. But his speech to me, which was very intelligent and was very compelling, was, you know, basically, you know, what you need to understand about us is that we're part of the Russian Orthodox Church. And this is about values and what your values are. And what's going to be true for 1,000 years? We think in 1,000-year increments. Mm-hmm. And what we believe is that your culture is perverted. And we don't want to be perverted. We want to be part of something, you know, that is strategic and is excellent and can go for thousands of years. Uh-huh. And we think in a whole different way than you do. Now, mm-hmm. It was a very good recruiting speech. Whether it was true or not, I leave to you. Yeah, no, I was very impressed too. And you got the feeling that you were dealing with a group of people who were truly formidable, because they, you know, you watch at how much attention Putin gives to the law whenever he talks about things and whenever he does things. Mm-hmm. It was as though they had a great understanding of the need to command moral authority. It's what the Chinese call the mandate of heaven. And, you know, they gave serious attention to building the mandate of heaven. Now, I've seen a series of speeches by one of his economic advisors, which I've been posting on the blog. And the interesting thing is that they're a short guy with dark hair. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
What he does a very good job of describing is, you know, we're going to have to all be part of creating new rules, and what we and the other nations that Putin is coordinating with, you know, it's pretty much the BRICS. We're all struggling with the issues of, okay, well, how do we create alternatives? And that, to me, that's the work that needs to be done, and that's what's happening. And I have to tell you, what I see is Putin is getting help from the, from different groups in the United States. And I think it's part of a variety of interests wanting to see those new arrangements made and the global economy becoming less fragile.
So, well, it's interesting because Glazyev, he was at one time one of the eager young reformers, but he actually resigned his government position as a protest against corruption. In 92, I think, he was involved in trade somehow. So he's an interesting man. I've known him for years. And he visited New York back at the time I wrote those WorldNet Daily articles, and The Nation had a reception for him, or in a meeting, a little conference beforehand, and they invited me. And I brought the last copies I had of that magazine, the two issues, and gave them to him. And I said, well, it's probably a waste, because both The Nation people looked horrified when I handed it to him. And I thought that was why I'd been invited, but they wanted me there for some other reason. I can't remember what. And I thought, well, those were my last copies. They'll get them away from him or whatever. But I think maybe they survived, and he actually read them.
I think he's a very sound fellow. Yeah. I like a lot of what he says.
He works a lot with Michael Hudson, who's quite a good.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah, I can see that. They fit.
Yeah. So, Glazyev, but what I wanted to say, I wanted to respond to your remarks about Putin, because that is one thing I see so clearly in this particular confrontation. I mean, I'm really impressed with how the Russians are handling it. They are so professional.
Well, I have to tell you that
if you
look at how they're handling the leadership are handling the sanctions, I cannot imagine a group of Americans handling it as well.
It's impossible to imagine. And even that Ministry of Defense press conference they had after the Malaysian airliner was shot down on a Thursday, they had it on a Monday in response to the wild charges the West started making against them. That was the most beautifully organized presentation. It was so crisp, so clear. They had their evidence all in order and their questions for the U.S. I mean, it was just magnificently well prepared. And, of course, Mr. Putin is constantly referencing the law and custom.
Right.
And, you know, they really look, I mean, I think the Americans are just kind of falling all over themselves with these ridiculous charges. You know, you've got to have some evidence before you accuse people of being murderers. And they don't have any. And, of course, the story's died, and who knows what M50...
Well, you know, in
the tapes, but...
You know, 10 years ago, if you could get spin to stick. And I think the global population has become more intelligent. And Putin seems to be very clever about understanding that the facts and the law matter if you're willing to not let the spin get under your skin.
Yeah.
And he seems to be able to do that. And I think they've watched, you know, two things. They've watched this media, you know, the really perverted media game for long enough and dealt with it long enough that they're getting, you know, a lot of people are getting smart. But there's something else, and that is, I think they know, if you live through what they lived through in the 90s, I think they know that the stakes are as high as they get.
Mm.
And so they have to win. They can't afford, you know, it's a little bit like the boats are burned. You can't go back.
Right.
And so they understand, if you don't stand up against this, what is going to happen to them? Because the 90s were genteel compared to what's going to happen this time.
Yeah, the 90s were just a particularly horrifying trailer.
Right.
Future will be.
Well, what you're watching in the Ukraine, if I'm right, is wholesale depopulation.
Yes. Yes, they have. I'm just waiting for, when are the Ukrainian people going to understand what they have done, the position they've put themselves in? by going along with this Madan business, it's a disaster for them. And eventually, of course, it's kind of a race. You know, the Russians are sitting back trying to keep everybody calm and sustain those poor people in the east who are being attacked best they can. These agreements they've made with the IMF, their government has made with the IMF, the Ukrainian government, the coup government, is, well, it's not a coup government anymore. The guy was elected. Those are really going to hurt.
Right.
And all the money we've given them already has disappeared. You know, we've already handed out about $3 billion and it's gone, and nobody knows where it went.
I can guess.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, we saw IMF bailouts in the 1990s, where mm-hmm. I believe the money never left Wall Street. It just went from the J.P. Morgan account for the IMF to the J.P. Morgan account for the country to the J.P. Morgan accounts for Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. This firm, that firm, this firm. And it just literally went from account to account at J.P. Morgan Chase, and the money never left J.P. Morgan Chase.
This is absolutely correct. And
right.
I know that happened in the Mexican bailout, that the money
right.
never left the country.
Right.
So, and I'm sure it happened many other times. Yeah. No,
right.
it's really a fantastic scam that has grown out of the Federal Reserve and the post World War II world and the collapse of Bretton Woods. I mean, this is such a demented economic system we're now attempting to sustain.
Well, even though the Americans engineered LaGuardian to the IMF, is it possible that this is getting so ugly and she won't go along with what they need to do next?
I really don't know. I mean, she's an interesting woman, but she's definitely part of the status quo. They're pretty ambivalent at the IMF about anything and everything, to tell you the truth. They just want to get their payments. It's a really rich, comfortable plantation, so they don't want that disturbed. On the other hand, they are educated people, and they have some understanding of the consequences of their policies. Their mission people have to live and witness it in those countries. So, yeah, you'd like to think there's some moral hesitation there. But I think such interests are now flying about that I don't see how you're going to keep all the Europeans in line, because, you know, France is in a different position than Germany with the Russians and the Dutch.
Right.
And, you know, I just think it's kind of what are all the politics there. And now, for instance, Hungary is being targeted because Viktor Orban, the president of that country, is not going along with the program. He's not even going along with the EU program. So, you know, you've got, it could be that something else is causing this attack on Ms. Lagarde. It could be purely French domestic politics, because
right, it could.
Her alleged violation was in favor of Sarkozy, who was recently charged with corruption. So it could be just that story and not an international one.
Well, also, but if you want to step back and look at it from the long view, it could be that we're dealing with a system that is so lacking in integrity that at some point everybody starts fighting by tearing each other apart.
Well,
so,
you know,
it's what Rick Perry said, you know, we can't have our political fights through indictments, but that you see that going on all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's very unsettling. And this ambition of the United States, they're trying to force issues. It's just, they do not. Well, I finally come to the conclusion that it doesn't matter to them. You look at a nation like Ukraine, this is such a complicated country. It goes, you know, it's been part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. It's been part of Poland. It's been part of Russia. I mean, you've got at least 700 violent years of history and misfortune in that country. And you go back to
World. And then you had Chernobyl, right?
But yeah, and back to World War II, with, you know, they aligned with the Germans and the fascists, and then they, you know, changed. I mean, it's just so many layers of groups that go back generations of beefs against one another. To go, I'm sure the Russians at first were just astonished at what the United States did, because they know perfectly well the U.S. has no opportunity to really control that country or understand what they unleashed. But for the United States, I think our foreign policy can be boiled down to this. It doesn't matter. Just kick up the dust. And then we improvise. You know, when they first set off for Ukraine, I think they actually had the idea they were going to get Crimea and the port there, even though that was never going to happen. Well, Mr. Putin did resolve that issue very efficiently and quickly, thank God, because I hate to think of where we'd be right now if he had not done that and the West had persisted. So, okay, they see, well, we don't get Crimea, but we can get all these, you know, military agreements and just short of NATO membership. We can go that far. So now that's their focus. And that's fine by them. They'll just sit and bide their time and, you know, with whatever mess. We see it in the Islamic State with the crazy business of arming those rebels with our own equipment. And now
well, sometimes I think what we just have is a whole market cap worth of companies that need to keep their earnings growing. And they're just swirling around like a, you know, like a swarm of insects just looking for the next fix.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's very hard for the American people to accept and understand, but a huge part of this economy is a war machine.
Yeah. But it's funny, there was an article posted of the number one search term in every country in the world, and you saw, I think I put it up on the blog, you saw a map and the word on every country that was the number one search term in that country, and the number one search term in the United States was war.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I do see the propaganda against Russia slowly you know, sort of succeeding with Americans. And that worries me, because at first it was pretty, it was largely rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Outside the United States, I think it's rejected, and people are getting even more upset by it, because they can see this is crazy, and we're the ones who are going to suffer. But, you know, they do... It's so successful, the media machine in the United States, they can orchestrate these crises so professionally now. It's truly terrifying.
Right.
I mean, just imagine if we didn't have the internet and we were still relying on major newspapers alone.
Right.
What if it were 20 years ago?
I don't know. Speaking of which, have you seen the new Jack Ryan movie?
No.
It's Kevin Costner. And here's the plot. The plot is the Russians have organized a financial attack to destroy the dollar. And Jack Ryan, Kevin Costner is in, are you ready for this? The covert operations at Treasury. And he recruits Jack Ryan to go in and save us from the Russians. And of course, we outwit the Russians and their attack on the dollar is destroyed. But it's, you know, and it was all orchestrated to kind of come out right at the right time.
Yeah.
And you look at this. I know.
Did you see the film, Catherine?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a terrible movie. I mean, don't plan on going it. You know, go there as an exercise in understanding the geopolitics. Do not go thinking you're going to be entertained. Although, you
really?
Know, I love Kevin Costner, so...
Well, if it's a bad film, that even more speaks towards or being part of an orchestration.
Yeah, Yeah, because if you look at how long it takes to finance and produce that, it took some time. Well, and before we close, just give us 5 minutes on Lock and Load and what you're up to and where it's going to go from here and how we stay current and support your work.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, Lock and Load is really, I'm using it as a vehicle to bring out Contagion. And another book I've done on Switzerland, it's not quite finished yet, but it's called Modern Switzerland, Shadow and Light, which became the country.
Oh, I'm dying to read that.
Yeah, it's a good one. And that's really Switzerland after the Cold War as well.
Uh-huh.
And the taking over of a healthy culture through finance and banking.
Yeah.
And, you know, why this small little mountain alpine country was such a focus of U.S. foreign policy back in 91 and 92. So
wow,
that's a very
yes.
interesting story. And then I have another one called All the World's Politics, which is about the island of Sark, which is the last feudal kingdom in Europe. It is not a member of the EU, and it is not subject to the British Parliament. The island and that community and polity exists on the basis of a lease signed with Elizabeth I. So the only obligation is to the crown, and I think the annual rent the senior has to pay is something like £7 sterling. It's just crazy. But two billionaires, the Barclay brothers, who own and are publishers of the UK Telegraph, have become involved. So you have this huge global money and this feisty little independent island loaded with British eccentrics. It's a great story. But what do these three stories have in common, this huge nation of Russia, former empire, and then this alpine country in Central Europe and a Channel Island? The theme is really about decentralization.
Uh-huh.
I think the answer for people,
right.
people all over the world, the nation state is actually a killer. It's going to be killing us domestically if we don't look out here. And
right.
the way to resolve it, it's not that different from what you're doing at Solari, the idea, which is to revitalize communities and truly reduce government. I'm an anarchist, so I'm happy to see the whole thing go down the tubes, but I can accept that.
Now, I thought you were an Austrian, not an anarchist.
Well, I am an Austrian, too.
Uh-huh.
I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I mean, over there was Rothbard, you know, the really radical people. But I accept that that's probably not going to see anything like that in my lifetime, except in the conditions of total collapse, which I hope none of us see.
Right.
So at any rate, it is an attempt to inform the United States a little bit, citizens of the United States, a little bit about the realities of Europe and the struggles there, and to get the information going the other way, because Europeans are rather badly informed on the U.S. So we have to get some dialogue going. We hope to focus on local movements, local entrepreneurs, especially in both the United States and Europe, considering the high youth unemployment. And the idea is these nanny states are forced to retreat. It doesn't necessarily mean that goods and services the government once provided are not needed or wanted. They are more
right.
than needed.
Right.
But young people can build the small companies for communities that can deliver those services.
I agree.
So we're hoping to generate that conversation as well. Now, with crowdfunding, is there really a place? Because it's happening.
Yes.
Well, I think there is, because I think people need to talk about and be inspired by what others have done or what others are thinking. So,
well, you can't build a financial system until you first build a media. That's
right.
why they wanted to get the media first in Russia before they did the financial system. So I agree with you. If we're going to decentralize and if we're going to, it's what Putin's advisor says, if we're going to make up new rules, we got to talk about it. And we've got to have a media that covers it. Yeah.
Right.
So, well, I think what you're doing is so wonderful, and we want to support it in every way. Every time you're ready to publish, you're ready to market, let us know. I'll write a book review. We'll get it out there. I can't wait. So,
well, I'm really looking forward to it. It's been very hard to watch this story unfold over the years and see how much of it was omitted and how that has distorted and made difficult for Americans to understand what really happened.
Right.
And what is the basis for the Russians' viewpoint of us.
Right.
There really are reasons for it. It's not
right.
just an emotional reaction.
Right.
So yeah, I'm looking forward. I appreciate it. I know you've got a great membership there and a great following, and I hope they'll take the time in the future to read the book once I've got it all done.
Okay. Well, Anne, have a wonderful day, and again, thank you very much. It was wonderful having you on the Solari Report.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Catherine.